Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, you're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. The following recording is intended solely for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. Thank you for joining us for the December 8th, Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Centennial, more housing could be coming to South Glen, by John Aguilar, the Denver Post. Doug Coe Schools, district takes up mask mandate, by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. And U.S.-Russia tensions over Ukraine, by Amar Madhani and Dasha Litvinova, the Associated Press. Centennial, more housing could be coming to South Glen. As retail centers change, developers looking to add residential units, by John Aguilar, the Denver Post. City leaders in Centennial expressed strong and unanimous support Tuesday night for a plan to allow the streets at South Glen Shopping Center to add a lot more housing while curtailing the amount of square footage dedicated to shopping, a reflection of the rapid adjustments that commercial property owners here and nationwide continue to make and ongoing upheaval in the retail sector. The council did all but take a final vote, which won't occur until Monday. But it was clear from comments from every council member Tuesday that they will be voting in favor next week. Centennial's discussion comes less than a month after Littleton narrowly approved a redevelopment plan for the Aspen Grove Shopping Center that will allow up to 2,000 residential units where none exist now. It also allows retail space to be reduced by half. And just last month, East-West Partners announced plans to pump life into a 13-acre west of Denver Cherry Creek Shopping Center, an effort the developer said will include a significant residential component. David Garcia, policy director at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at the University of California at Berkeley, said what is happening in Metro Denver is part of an emerging trend in the country where the changing retail landscape is dovetailing with an acute housing shortage in many urban areas. Earlier this year, several lawmakers in California introduced legislation to make it easier to convert commercially zoned property into residential use to address the state's housing shortage, he said. Metro Denver has its own housing crunch to deal with. There is such a demand for housing, Garcia said. It follows the trend of trying to put existing land to the highest and best use. At the streets at South Glen, a 77-acre outdoor shopping district laid out in a street grid with familiar brands like Whole Foods, Best Buy, and Snooze, the maximum number of allowable housing units would go from 350 to 1,125, while the minimum amount of retail space as outlined in the shopping center's agreement with the city would drop from just more than 900,000 square feet to 621,000 square feet. There are approximately 750,000 square feet of retail at the streets at South Glen now, and just more than 200 housing units, said David Provost, founding partner at the Denver-based Alberta Development Partners. The shopping center, owned by Alberta, opened a dozen years ago at the southwest corner of East Arapahoe Avenue and South University Boulevard, replacing the long forlorn South Glen Mall that sat at the location for decades. He said the reconfiguration at South Glen is necessary in a retail environment that has been battered by consumers moving their dollars online, a phenomenon that has only quickened during a pandemic that complicates face-to-face transactions. There has been an acceleration in the last 15 years, and especially in the last 5 years with online shopping, Provost said. We want the existing retail at South Glen to thrive. The core of the retail remains. The plan to add hundreds of homes to the streets at South Glen largely involves around finding a way to best fill space opened by a recently shuttered Sears store at the site and a Macy's that is set to close in March, two big box retail formats that have fallen out of favor among shoppers. Alberta is partnering with Northwood Investors, which owns the empty Sears building. Construction on the new housing could begin late next year, and new residents moving in 2023 or 2024, Provost said. We need to look at enhancing the long-term viability of South Glen, he said, and that means determining what the mix of shopping, entertainment, and residences needs to be to make the retail more productive, said Neil Marciniak, Centennial's Economic Development Director. The streets at South Glen contributes around $3 million a year to Centennial's overall $40 million sales tax haul, Marciniak said. While he said cities live and die by their sales tax collections, their shopping centers have to evolve with the larger market. What is the appropriate mix to prepare for the future? Marciniak said. All shopping centers need to be looking at their tenant mix, their land use mix. Consumers want an experience. The mixed-use model across the country is a difficult formula to figure out and not always an easy sell. Alberta consulted with neighbors for 3 years or so before putting their plan before Centennial City Council. Despite providing setbacks and tiered building heights to make new apartment buildings less intrusive to the surrounding neighborhood, not all residents are happy with the proposal. Linda Nixon, chair of the South Glen Civic Association, still worries about too much density and the traffic those new residents will produce. The shopping center is largely surrounded by single-family homes built in the 1970s and 1980s. You're talking a lot of cars, she said. It's going to totally increase traffic. But Andrew Spaulding, a longtime resident of the area long before there was a city of Centennial and who worked at the former South Glen Mall, said Alberta worked diligently with the community to blunt any impacts. We're hoping it is less intrusive than other developments in the city, where they build right up to the street, he said. It's one of those. It's coming. How do we soften it? I think ultimately it will be a benefit to the community. Doug Coe Schools. District takes up mask debate. New board discusses dropping mandate on face coverings, by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. Douglas County School Board members considered Tuesday whether to drop a mask mandate for the school district, but first heard from parents, students, and other residents who waved American flags, cheered, and whistled as people mostly spoke against face coverings. The resolution that the Board of Education was considering says the district will not mandate masks in schools unless they are required by federal, state, or local laws or public health orders. The school board also not set a COVID-19 vaccine mandate for students or district staff, according to the resolution. The board recommends, regardless of vaccination status, personal and parent choice with respect to whether or not children should wear face coverings while at school, while also allowing for appropriate and necessary accommodations of students with disabilities, reads the resolution. As of 9:30 p.m., the board had not voted on the mask mandate resolution. The immediate effect a board vote to end the mask mandate would have is unclear. A federal judge blocked a mask exemption from Douglas County's new health department in October, saying it violated the rights of students with disabilities. During the meeting, three school board members wore masks and four did not. The first five speakers were students, none of whom wore masks, who opposed face coverings in schools and urged the new school board to do away with them. The Denver Post was unable to get speakers' names. Me and my friends have a hard time communicating with masks, one student said, adding, I feel like masks suffocate me. They were followed by at least three other students who were in favor of face coverings in schools, with one student saying that masks will help keep students in school. But those first speakers set the tone for the public comments section, which, as it neared its third hour just before 8 p.m., saw more students and parents speak out against face coverings in schools, which they framed as a parental choice, as they expressed their support for the new members of the board. People attending the meeting waved American flags and at least one pride flag when they heard a speaker they supported, an action that one speaker said only makes for a circus. It is embarrassing. This comment only led to more flag waving. The meeting comes a month after four new conservative members, all against mask mandates, were elected to the school board. They hold a majority on the seven-member board. I completely support you taking these muzzles off our children, a woman told school board members on Tuesday. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends universal masking inside school buildings for students and staff. The agency discovered that counties without face covering requirements saw larger increases in COVID-19 cases in children after the start of school during the 2021-22 year, according to a September 24 study. Colorado saw a rise in COVID-19 cases among students after school returned in the fall, most notably among those ages 5 to 11 years old, who were not eligible for a vaccine until November. Infections among children recently declined, but public health officials have warned that they could increase again as the holidays approach. The board heard from more parents and students in support of masks in schools later in the evening. One parent who is also a healthcare worker spoke in support of masks in schools, saying she knew a child who now gets hospitalized with other viruses since getting COVID-19 because the disease damaged their lungs so much despite initially having a mild illness. She also described the difficulty hospitals are facing as the number of COVID-19 patients has increased statewide in recent months, saying she had a patient she had to drive to Aurora because no beds were available in Douglas County. I understand that we are all tired, and I can guarantee you that no one is more tired than healthcare workers and educators, she said.
Well, that's pretty much what I said to her.
U.S.-Russia tensions over Ukraine. Biden. An invasion could bring penalties, by Amar Madhani and Dasha Litvinova, the Associated Press. Washington. Face-to-face for more than 2 hours, President Joe Biden and Russia's Vladimir Putin squared off in a secure video call Tuesday as the U.S. president put Moscow on notice that an invasion of Ukraine would bring sanctions and an enormous harm to the Russian economy. With tens of thousands of Russian troops massed on the Ukraine border, the highly anticipated call between the two leaders came amid growing worries by the U.S. and Western allies about Russia's threat to its neighbor. Putin, for his part, came into the meeting seeking guarantees from Biden that the NATO military alliance will never expand to include Ukraine, which has long sought membership. The Americans and their NATO allies said that request was a non-starter. There appeared to be no immediate breakthroughs to ease tensions on the Ukraine question, as the U.S. emphasized the need for diplomacy and de-escalation and issued stern threats to Russia on the consequences of an invasion. Biden told Putin directly that if Russia further invades Ukraine, the United States and our European allies would respond with strong economic measures, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said after the call. He added that Biden said the U.S. would also provide additional defensive material to the Ukrainians, and we would fortify our NATO allies on the eastern flank with additional capabilities in response to such an escalation. That could include additional deployments of U.S. troops to eastern European NATO allies, the advisor said. A top U.S. envoy, Victoria Nuland, said a Russian invasion of Ukraine also would jeopardize a controversial pipeline between Russia and Germany. She told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee Tuesday that if Russia invaded, our expectation is that the pipeline will be suspended. Putin's foreign affairs advisor, Yuri Yushakov dismissed the sanctions threat during a conference call with reporters. While the U.S. president talked about possible sanctions, our president emphasized what Russia needs, Yushakov said. Sanctions aren't something new. They've been in place for a long time and will not have any effect. He described the president's video conference as candid and businesslike, adding they also exchanged occasional jokes. In a brief snippet broadcast by Russia's state television, the two leaders offered friendly greetings to each other. I welcome you, Mr. President, Putin said, speaking with a Russian flag behind him and a video monitor showing Biden in front of him. Good to see you again, Biden replied with a chuckle. He noted Putin's absence from the recent Group of 20 summit in Rome. Putin took part by video link because of concerns about COVID-19 and said, I hope next time we meet to do it in person. At the White House, Sullivan said, it was a useful meeting, allowing Biden to lay out in candid terms where the U.S. stands. As the U.S. and Russian presidents conferred, Ukraine grew only more anxious about the tens of thousands of Russia troops that have been deployed near its border. Ukrainian officials charged Russia had further escalated the smoldering crisis by sending tanks and snipers to war-torn eastern Ukraine to provoke return fire and lay a pretext for a potential invasion. U.S. intelligence officials have not been able to independently verify that accusation, according to an administration official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the sensitive matter. But the official said that the White House has directly raised concerns with the Russians about resorting to their old playbook by trying to provoke the Ukrainians. The Kremlin, in a post-call readout, said Putin emphasized that it's wrong to put the responsibility on Russia, since it is NATO that has been making dangerous attempts to expand its presence in the Ukraine territory and has been expanding its military potential near Russian borders. The Russian leader also proposed to lift all mutual restrictions on the diplomatic missions and help normalize other aspects of bilateral relations, the Kremlin said. Sullivan said the leaders would direct their staffs to continue negotiations on that. The leader-to-leader conversation, Biden speaking from the White House Situation Room, Putin from his residence in Sochi, was one of the most important of Biden's presidency and came at a perilous time. U.S. intelligence officials have determined that Russia has massed 70,000 troops near the Ukrainian border and has made preparations for a possible invasion early next year. Sullivan said the U.S. believes that Putin has not yet made a final decision to invade. Biden was vice president in 2014 when Russian troops marched into the Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea and annexed the territory from Ukraine. Aides said the Crimea episode, one of the darker moments for President Barack Obama on the international stage, looms large as Biden looks at the smoldering current crisis. Politically in Washington, Republicans are framing this moment as a key test of Biden's leadership on the global stage. Biden vowed as a candidate to reassert American leadership after President Donald Trump's emphasis on an America First foreign policy. But Republicans say he's been ineffective in slowing Iran's march toward a nuclear power and has done too little to counter autocratic leaders, including China's Xi Jinping and Putin. Fellow authoritarians in Beijing and Tehran will be watching now how the free world responds, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said from the Senate floor before the Biden-Putin meeting. Sullivan said Biden and Putin had a good discussion on the Iran issue and called it an area where the two countries could cooperate. The more Iran demonstrates a lack of seriousness at the negotiating table, the more there will be a sense of unity among the U.S. and the parties to their 2015 nuclear accord, including Russia and the European Union, he said. Trump, who showed unusual deference to Putin during his presidency, said in a statement that Vladimir Putin looks at our pathetic surrender in Afghanistan leaving behind dead soldiers, American citizens, and $85 billion worth of military equipment. He then looks at Biden. He is not worried. Ahead of the Putin call, Biden on Monday spoke with leaders of the United Kingdom, France, and Germany, and Italy to coordinate messaging and potential sanctions. He also spoke with them, again following his call to brief them out the outcome. Biden is also expected to speak with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Thursday. Omicron in Boulder. Data, variant spreading at low levels, by Meg Wingerter, the Denver Post. The Boulder County resident who tested positive for the Omicron variant of COVID-19 after traveling abroad likely isn't the only person in the community who has it, and the public should keep taking precautions against the virus, state health officials said Tuesday. The Delta variant still accounts for the vast majority of COVID-19 cases in Colorado. But the state has confirmed two cases of the new Omicron variant, both in people who have recently traveled to southern Africa, and a sampling of Boulder's municipal wastewater system picked up some of the variant's distinctive mutations, state epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said at a news conference. Wastewater testing can't pinpoint how many people may have been affected, but the results suggest more than one person likely has Omicron, Herlihy said. However, the new variant doesn't appear to be widespread in Boulder. There's probably some low level of community transmission, she said. The first Omicron infection in Colorado was confirmed in an Arapahoe County woman, but state officials have not reported any spread related to that case. Herlihy urged people who develop COVID-19 symptoms or know they were exposed to get a PCR test, which looks for the virus's genetic material. While at-home rapid tests are a good screening tool, the state can't use them to track which variants are spreading in the community, she said. Our detection system only works if people get tested, she said. So far, Omicron doesn't appear to be causing more hospitalizations in South Africa, where it was first confirmed, than previous versions of SARS-CoV-2, which is reassuring so far, Herlihy said. It does seem to be spreading more rapidly than the Delta variant, but it's not clear if that's because it's more contagious or because it's better at infecting people who are vaccinated who have recovered from COVID-19 infection via another variant. It's possible both could be factors, but the world won't know with certainty for a few weeks. The overall picture of Colorado's COVID-19 situation is somewhat unclear. Hospitalizations had fallen for about a week, but rose again Tuesday with 1,419 people receiving inpatient care statewide for confirmed COVID-19. It's possible that's a short-term effect from Thanksgiving gatherings, but it will take at least a few more days of data to know, Herlihy said. The percentage of tests coming back positive has trended down, though it's still above the state's 5% goal. The 7-day average number of cases had dropped in late November, rebounded in the first days of December, and dropped again over the weekend. Sometimes drops disappear as delayed reports come in, adding another layer of difficulty in sorting out what's happening. It's a good idea to continue practicing social distancing and to consider wearing medical-grade masks in indoor public settings, Herlihy said. New data also show that booster shots can provide an extra level of protection, with Coloradans who receive an extra dose about 3 times less likely to be hospitalized than those who have only completed their first shot sequence, and 47 times less likely than those who are unvaccinated. People who are vaccinated but haven't had a booster shot are 11 times less likely to be hospitalized for COVID-19 than those who are unvaccinated. Governor Jared Polis urged people who haven't been able to get an appointment for a booster shot to consider one of the state's mass vaccination sites. Arapahoe Community College, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday. Aurora Medical Municipal Center, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday. Chapel Hills Mall, Colorado Springs, 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. daily. Citadel Mall, Colorado Springs, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Douglas County Fairgrounds, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday. La Plata County Fairgrounds, 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Pueblo Mall, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Tuesday through Sunday. Weld County Clerk and Recorder Building, Greeley, 8:30 a.m. to 6:10 p.m. Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. 12:30 to 4:30 p.m. Wednesday. 8:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Saturday. The sites also offer first and second shots for both adults and children. Appointments are available but not required. We want it to be available to you today, Polis said of the vaccine. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Fern Baron, 71, Denver, wife of Udi Baron, mother of Itai, wife Darcy Baron, and Robin, husband Justin Murkow, sister of Sharon, husband Perry Jung, California, Bruce, wife Bridget, chef Illinois, Peter, wife Susie Krulovich, Texas, and Thomas, wife Britt Krulovich, California, grandmother of Max, Levi, Tamar, Tommy, Zohar, Ishai, and Shahar. Graveside Thursday, 12 noon, Mount Nebo Memorial Park. Live stream on Feldman's Mortuary YouTube channel. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Jewish Family Service of Colorado. Carmen Celestine Dalla, December 12, 1944, November 16, 2021. Rosary will be on December 9, 2021 at 6:30 p.m. Funeral Mass on 12/10/2021, beginning at 11 a.m. Services will be held at Spirit of Christ, 7400 West 80th Avenue, Arvada, followed by Entombment, St. Francis Mausoleum, Mount Olivet Cemetery. Survived by siblings Louis, Charles, Mary, husband Albert. For full obituary, please see CFCS Colorado. Dennis Gartland, September 7, 1953 to November 21, 2021. Dennis Manley Gartland, 68, died at his home on Sunday, November 21, 2021, of natural causes. Dennis was born on September 7, 1953, in Denver, Colorado, to Barbara and Edward Gartland. Dennis was the fifth of eight children. He attended St. James Catholic School and graduated from Mullen High School in 1971. He began working in restaurants as a teenager, including the hatch cover, and eventually went on to get his associate's degree from the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. Dennis was a chef at several high-end restaurants and hotels, including the Hitching Post in Cheyenne, Wyoming, the Fairmont Hotel, and Stauffer's in Denver. Dennis, his family, and friends loved to gather at the Blue Goose Bar in Glendale, where he was the bar manager and later the proud owner. After his career in hospitality, Dennis worked in construction. In 2020, he retired from Adolphson and Peterson after 25 years of hard work at the company. Dennis is survived by his daughter, Kit Garland, his brothers, Patrick, Michael, Kevin, Timothy, James, and Matthew, and many nieces, nephews, in-laws, and friends. His parents and two sisters, Ellen and Mary Jane, preceded him in death. Dennis was generous, funny, and kind to everyone who crossed his path. His motto was to treat others the way you want to be treated. He loved to tell jokes and stories, give advice about cooking or home repairs, and pick up the bar tab. He is deeply missed. His memorial service will be held on Wednesday, December 15th at 1 p.m. at Horan and McConaty, Colorado, 1091 South Colorado Boulevard, Denver, 80246, with a reception to follow at the original Brooklands, 2644 West Colfax Avenue, Denver, Colorado, 80204. In lieu of flowers, please consider making a donation in Dennis's honor to the Hope Center, www.hopecenterinc.org. Iola Glista, May 10, 1938 to November 28, 2021. Iola Glista passed away on November 28, 2021. She was preceded in death by her parents, Elizabeth and Rudolph Ciccone, husband Louis Glista, and stepson Paul Glista. Iola is survived by her sister Aurora Weaver, sons Mario Glista, Anthony Glista, and daughter-in-law Meredith Lehman. Also survived by many family members and friends. Services December 9th at St. Mark Catholic Church, 3141 West 96th Avenue, Westminster, 80031. Viewing 10 a.m., funeral mass 10:30 a.m., followed by luncheon and burial at Mount Olivet Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, family encourages contributions to Brain Injury Alliance of Colorado, Camp Fund, 1325 South Colorado Boulevard, Suite B300, Denver, Colorado, 80222. www.biacolorado.org. Marilyn May Johnson, May 20th, 1932 to November 30th, 2021. Passed away peacefully in Littleton, Colorado. See full obituary on legacy.com. John A. Jack Lynch, June 24, 1942 to November 20, 2021. The world lost a wonderful man on November 20, 2021. Born in Pagosa Springs, Colorado to Ben and June Lynch, Jack died unexpectedly of a heart attack. He graduated from Pagosa Springs High School, where he was a member of the 1960 state championship basketball team. He attended Fort Lewis Junior College, where he was named a Junior College All-American in 1962. He was inducted into the FLC Hall of Fame in 1995. Just months ago, his son Mike was inducted, making them the only father-son duo to share the honor of at FLC. Graduating from CSU with a Bachelor of Science degree in 1964 and a Master's of Science degree in 1971. Jack was a teacher, coach, and school administrator in the Aurora Public Schools for 40 years. He served as Director of Athletics and Activities for 20 of those years. He was honored as Outstanding Athletic Administrator by the Colorado Athletics Director Association in 1995 and 1996, named Athletic Director of the Year by the National Council of Secondary School Athletic Directors. He received recognition for community leadership from the Aurora Chamber of Commerce in 2004. Jack was a high school football official, back judge, line judge, referee for many years and assigned to 9 CHASS state championship football games. He later officiated football in the RMAC, the Western Athletic Conference, and the Mountain West Conference. An avid golfer, he played several times a week and relished winning skins from the golf buddies. He was proud to have been on many winning teams and tournaments, especially at the 1980 and 1981 Pueblo Italian Invitational. Jack has been a Broncos season ticket holder for 55 years and is among the original 1,500 owners of season tickets for the Colorado Rockies. He is survived by his wife of 38 years, Debbie, sons Patrick and Michael, wife Nisa, grandchildren Megan, Christopher, Lauren, and Jack, and great-grandsons Ian and Beckham, brothers Ben, wife Judy, and Casey, wife Lori, and sister Maureen, all of whom reside in the southwestern part of the state. Brothers-in-law Gary Rosso, wife Wendy, and Sol Rosso, wife Kay, sister-in-law Deanne Rosso, 5 nephews, and a niece were also an important part of his life. Jack was blessed with many good friends, including Chuck, Michelle, Tom Patterson, and Jody Lynch, Dick Johnson, Jim Wrights, Dave Melton, Gene Hahn, deceased, and Bob Adams, deceased. Jack will be remembered for his wonderful sense of humor. A good joke was always welcome. He had a strong sense of right and wrong, which he exercised judiciously in his professional and personal life. His influence was far-reaching, particularly in the Aurora community and among young people. Jack was known to be fair, funny, and a natural leader. His kind heart will be greatly missed. A celebration of life will be held on Thursday, December 9th, 2021, at 10:30 a.m. at the Chapel of Horan McConaty, 11150 East Dartmouth Avenue, Denver, 80014. Reception and lunch at the Heart Light Center will follow the service. In lieu of flowers, those who wish may consider a donation in Jack's name to the City of Aurora Junior Golf Program, 15151 East Alameda, Aurora, 80012, or to Food Bank of the Rockies, Attention Maggie, 10700 45th Avenue, Denver, 80239, or via the website at foodbankrockies.org. Emiliana Marie Romero, March 27, 1941 to December 1st, 2021. For full obituary and service information, please visit cfcscolorado.org/obituaries. Charlie Maceo Shibao, June 4, 1931 to December 3rd, 2021. A celebration of life will be held at the Armory Event Center, 300 Strong Street, Brighton, Colorado, on Friday, December 10th, 2021, from 2 to 6 p.m. Paul W. Stafford, August 22nd, 1947 to December 1st, 2021. Paul, 74, of Denver, Colorado, passed away peacefully at home. Known for his beaming smile and love of music, Paul is survived by his wife Patty, sons Tony and Philip, sisters Susan Craddock and Linda Myers, and brother Warren Stafford. Visitation Thursday, December 9th at 6:30 p.m., Horan and McConaty, 7577 West 80th Avenue, Arvada. Funeral Mass Friday, December 10th at 11 a.m., Mount Carmel, 3549 Navajo Street, Denver, followed by burial at Mount Olivet. For full obituary, head to HoranCares.com. Carol R. Stokeland, July 29, 1935 to November 22, 2021. Carol R. Stokeland, 86, passed away on November 22, 2021. Survived by her loving husband of 68 years, Bruce J. Stokeland, and her four children, Bruce, wife Rochelle, Mark, Carrie, husband Ivor, and Christy. Please visit allstatescremation.com for full obituary. Ruth Diane White, November 20th, 1945 to December 2nd, 2021. Ruth Diane White, 76, of Stanton, formerly of Toledo, Ohio, Steamboat Springs, Colorado, Denver, Colorado, and Green Valley, Arizona, passed away Wednesday, December 2nd, 2021, at her home with her family present. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.johnsonfs.com. Douglas E. Wilhelm, beloved husband, father, teacher, and friend, passed away November 28, 2021 in Denver. Please visit monarchsociety.com for full obituary. Obituary. Bailey is remembered as DPS's moral compass. Her report showed treatment of black educators, students by Melanie Asmar, Chalk Beach, Colorado. Denver Public Schools lost its moral compass with the passing of District Ombudsman Sharon Bailey on Friday, according to friends and colleagues. A straightforward critic of the institutional racism she saw in the district, Bailey was also a compassionate leader who believed the system could change and was willing to help, they said. In 2016, Bailey authored a seminal report about the treatment of black educators and students in Denver that served as a catalyst for the district's current black excellence efforts. The report has a long name, but everyone simply calls it the Bailey Report. She knew all the research, all the data, all the negativity going on, but Dr. Bailey had this hope in her that things were going to be better, that we could do this, said Vernon Jones Jr., a longtime Denver Public Schools educator and former school leader. Her husband, John Bailey, said of his wife, she was the smartest one here. Bailey, 68, died at her home Friday, the district said in a statement. 3 days earlier, on Tuesday, she spoke at a meeting honoring outgoing Denver school board members. She urged the incoming board members to focus on three things: recognizing the history of institutional racism in Denver schools, changing mindsets so they could create equity becomes a collective responsibility, and sustaining those efforts through a mix of transparency and accountability. She was whatever the word is for compass, stake in the ground, directional, said State Rep Jennifer Bacon, who left the Denver School Board Tuesday after 4 years of service. Bailey grew up in Denver and attended schools in the northeast part of the city. Happy Haynes, a former school board member and city councilor who is now executive director of the Denver Parks and Recreation, met Bailey when they were students at East High School in the 1960s. Haynes said she and Bailey advocated for teaching of what was then called Afro-American history, an effort that resulted in the first such class being taught at East. Our advocacy was really all about, we want our history. We want to be acknowledged, Haynes said. Those early efforts prepared us both. After graduating from East, Bailey got her undergraduate degree from Princeton University and eventually earned a doctorate degree in public administration from the University of Colorado. Her dissertation, entitled A Journey Full Circle, An Historical Analysis of Keys versus School District No. 1, examined efforts to desegregate Denver schools. Bailey witnessed those efforts firsthand. As a parent with children in Denver schools, she served on the Denver School Board from 1988 to 1995, at times as the only member of color. She was on the board when a judge ended a decades-long court-ordered program of busing students to schools in different neighborhoods to achieve racial integration. Worried the district would lose sight of the importance of equity once busing ended, Bailey sponsored a resolution in 1995 declaring, in part, that the district would give all students equal academic opportunities and that student discipline would be free from bias. The resolution passed unanimously, but the issues it aimed to address didn't go away. Her 2016 Bailey Report, commissioned by the district, found black students were disciplined more harshly and had fewer resources dedicated to their academic success than students of other races. A qualitative report based on interviews with 70 black students, with 70 black teachers and administrators, it also found that black educators felt isolated and passed over for promotions. The report led to the creation of a district-wide African-American equity task force, which made 11 recommendations, including that every school be required to write a plan for how to better serve black students and that the curriculum should be culturally relevant. Bacon was one of the educators interviewed for Bailey's report. She said it was a major reason she ran for the school board in 2017. 2 years later, in 2019, Bacon sponsored a Black Excellence Resolution codifying some of the task force recommendations. In 2020, the board voted to require the teaching of the contributions of Black, Latino, and Indigenous communities. She always wanted us to know the history of Denver Public Schools and of Denver because of history unknown is a history repeated, Bacon said. Mentoring younger leaders was important to Bailey. She knew one day the torch or the baton would be passed to us, and she wanted us to be ready, Jones said. He said Bailey and her husband, John, set an example for an entire generation of black leaders. We saw them exemplifying what it means to love your family and love your community, and that you can do both, Jones said. That was probably the best gift she gave. After authoring the Bailey Report, Bailey took a job as a senior advisor for equity initiatives at the Denver Public Schools before being appointed the district ombudsman this year. The ombuds office was envisioned as a confidential space for employees to express their concerns. Bailey's experiences made her uniquely suited to the role, the district said. In the old days, the revolutionary language was working in the belly of a beast, Haynes said, and that's what Sharon was doing. Even though she was a critic, sometimes a harsh critic of the district and what was happening in public education generally, she was also willing to step in and help and say, here's what you need to do. Bacon, Jones, and others said they worry about how Denver Public Schools will fill the role Bailey played. Bailey's husband, John, said she would want others to continue her work. She would say, don't mourn for me, do more for kids and community, he said. In her last public remarks before the school board Tuesday, as part of a tribute to Bacon's service on the board, Bailey herself issued a present call to action. In some circles, they call me the OG, the old girl, the old guard, Bailey said. But there are lessons to be learned with a long view of the historical inequities in the school district. What I do know for sure is that genuine educational equity in our district and around the nation has been elusive. Where is it? How will we know it when we see it? What will it look like? What will it feel like? So I contend that we simply can't believe in equity, fairness, and justice in education. We have to create it. A community celebration of Dr. Sharon Bailey's life will be held at New Hope Baptist Church, 3701 Colorado Boulevard, Denver, from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday. A homegoing memorial service will be held at the same location from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Colorado woman picked as astronaut candidate. NASA announced as 10 new astronaut recruits out of a pool of more than 12,000 applicants, and a woman from Colorado made the cut. On Monday, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson introduced the new members of the 2021 astronaut class during an event in Houston. Today we welcome 10 new explorers, 10 members of the Artemis generation, NASA's 2020 astronaut candidate class, Nelson said. Alone, each candidate has the right stuff, but together they represent the creed of our country, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. Among the 10 selected members is Nicole Vapor Ayers, 32, of Divide. She graduated from Woodland Park High School in Woodland Park and then the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs in 2011 with a bachelor's degree in mathematics and with a minor in Russian, according to NASA. She went on to earn her master's degree in computational and applied mathematics from Rice University. At the time of her application to NASA, she was the assistant director of operations at the 90th Fighter Squadron in Elmendorf Air Force Base, Alaska, according to NASA. The candidates will report for duty in January 2022 and then will undergo 2 years of initial astronaut training. Montana. State seeks to end protections for glacier area grizzlies by Matthew Brown, the Associated Press. Billings, Montana. Montana is asking the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to lift threatened species protections for grizzly bears in the northern portion of the state, including areas in and around Glacier National Park, officials said Monday. The state's request comes after bear populations grew in recent decades, skirting more run-ins, including grizzly attacks on livestock and periodic maulings of people. Removing federal protections would give state wildlife officials more flexibility to deal with bears that get into conflict, Montana Governor Greg Gianforte said. But wildlife advocates warned of overhunting if protections are lifted. Northwest Montana has the largest concentration of grizzlies in the lower 48 states, with more than 1,000 bears across an area that includes Glacier National Park and large expanses of forested wilderness. In March, U.S. government scientists said the region's grizzlies are biologically recovered but need continued protection under the Endangered Species Act because of human-caused bear deaths and other pressures. Hunting of grizzlies is banned in the U.S. outside Alaska. Bears considered problematic are regularly killed by wildlife officials. "We've shown the ability to manage bears, protect their habitat and population numbers," Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Director Hank Warsich said in a statement. "It's time for us to have full authority for grizzly bears in Montana." But wildlife advocates caution against giving the state control over grizzlies after Republicans, including Gianforte, have advanced policies that make it easier to kill another controversial predator, the gray wolf. "We don't believe that there should be hunting of these iconic native carnivores," said environmentalist John Horning with the group Wild Earth Guardians. "I have no doubt the state would push it to the absolute limits they could kill as many grizzlies as possible." The Fish and Wildlife Service had not yet received the state's petition and had no immediate comment, spokesperson Joe Suswalik said. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, who oversees Fish and Wildlife Service, co-sponsored legislation while in Congress to increase protections for bears and introduce them on tribal lands. As many as 50,000 grizzlies once ranged the western half of the U.S. Most were killed by hunting, trapping, and habitat loss following the arrival of European settlers in the late 1800s. Populations had declined to fewer than 1,000 bears by the time they were given federal protections in 1975. Protections were removed for more than 700 bears in and around Yellowstone National Park in 2017, but later restored by a federal judge. Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon said in September he will ask the federal government to remove protections for Yellowstone region grizzlies and permit the region's three states to manage and potentially allow hunting of the big bruins in certain areas. This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. We invite you to please stay tuned for our next program.
Women and low-income students disproportionately put their college careers on hold during the pandemic, according to a new report. Of the 13,000 Coloradans who stopped out of college over the past 3 years, 43% were students of color. Angie Piccioni with the Colorado Department of Higher Education explains when family members got sick and couldn't go to work, many students stepped in to help out.
We forget that there are extended families, especially in different cultures, where everybody pitches in, and it's not just mom, dad, and, you know, two children. When you have to pitch in for the entire family, then students of color in particular have stopped out.
When elementary schools closed, many adult students who couldn't afford childcare also decided to stay home with their kids. Piccioni says the state is making big investments to help these students return to classrooms to finish degrees or to get skills needed to land higher paying jobs. Students can connect with scholarships, tutoring, food assistance, and other supports online at readytoriseco.org. Piccioni says completing a degree or certificate program is critical for maximizing a student's lifetime earning potential. She points to the Finish What You Started program as a great way to get back on track.
This is scholarship money and wraparound services at the institutions of higher ed that will help students who have started a degree but had to drop out for whatever reason. Life happens. Finish what they started.
Many of the state's four-year colleges can now award associate degrees to students who completed enough coursework before stopping out. Pachoni says her team is also working to expand apprentice opportunities across the state.
To try to give students an early experience in the workforce so that, number one, they can see what they're missing, and number two, they can see what they need, and the employer can also try out, so to speak, students before they actually offer them a position.
Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This is Primetime Postscript. I'm Mike Cuthbert. Rome wasn't built in a day, and seeing it in 24 hours is nearly impossible unless you run. So lace up your sneakers and join our intrepid reporter Nancy Greenlease on a sight jogging tour.
I step into a hotel near St. Peter's Square and immediately spot my group. Tourists stand out in Rome because they're often overweight and wearing white sneakers. June Kennedy has the mandatory foot gear, but legs like Michelangelo's David. Still, the North Carolina tourist isn't sure what she's gotten herself into.
How fast do you run?
Well, it depends on how fast you want to run. Can you tell me what sort of runner you are?
Catherine Feehan, a lean Australian, is our guide. She figures out a pace that works for the two of us and instructs us to lift our feet high to avoid tripping on Rome's ancient speed bumps, cobblestones.
Okay, well, is everyone ready to get started?
All set.
Okay, let's go then.
Kennedy, who's here with her church choir, and I are soon following our guide's bouncing ponytail and breathless narrative along the narrow streets.
And what we're coming up to is a church called Santa Maria in Trastevere.
Okay.
We'll slow down a little bit because it's quite an interesting church. So it was built in the year 499. Inside, the mosaics are beautiful. The roof is topped with like golden mosaics and artwork. It's really, really nice. So it was rebuilt.
But we won't see the splendor in this church or a dozen others that we pass. Our shorts and sleeveless tops aren't exactly Pope-approved attire. Besides, we need to keep moving. Sight jogging tours give a fleeting glimpse of a large swath of the city. The idea is that the tourists will return later to favorite sites, if they survive. Traffic races along near the Tiber River. There's barely a sidewalk, much less a jogging lane. A bus nearly flattens us as we head toward the wedding cake. That's what locals call the showy building honoring Italy's first king.
Have you seen Piazza Venezia? The big white monument?
Yeah.
The Romans hate it.
So do we. And since we're on foot, we can make a quick escape. Unlike the travelers who wait on lumbering tour buses, we dash to a beloved monument.
Fontana di Trevi, as it said in Italian.
We gaze at the flamboyant fountain where Neptune rides his chariot atop cascading water. Actress Anita Ekberg in La Dolce Vita did a sultry romp in this fountain, and we could use a dip ourselves. Tourists stand with their backs to the monument.
Legend is that if you throw one coin over your shoulder, you'll return to Rome. If you throw another coin over your shoulder, you'll fall in love in Rome.
It's a love for Rome that prompted former personal trainer Carolina Gasparetto to found Sight Jogging 3 years ago. She first broached the idea to her brother and sister-in-law while seated in the back seat of their car.
The two of them turned around and asked, "Running?"
Why did they think it was crazy?
They're very lazy.
But they are typically Italian. Italians don't even run for the bus. They prefer a passeggiata or a stroll. And as my legs throb, I'm beginning to understand why.
Rome is built on 7 hills, and we just went up one. Luckily, we're going back down. If we were hitting all 7 hills, the story would end right about here.
Yet adrenaline from the run and the unusual sights keeps me chugging along. As we approach our final stop, the Vatican, Fian encourages us to slow down.
Because it's not every day you get to run down to the entrance of St. Peter.
Hello.
And this is awesome. Yeah, it's such a beautiful site.
The sun is setting, giving the basilica a yellow glow. All told, we scampered about 10 kilometers. We saw, we sweated. Fian says sight jogging also allows us to indulge in another Roman tradition.
And then you go and enjoy your gelato afterwards. Yes, that's fantastic.
It's true, sight jogging may assuage some guilt for gluttonous visitors, not only in Rome, but in Venice and Florence, where sight jogging tours may soon be hoofing it across town.
This has been Primetime Postscript, made possible by AARP, and today, Nancy Greenlease. See pictures and hear more postscripts on our website, aarp.org/radio.
This year, AINC is raising $30,000 in celebration of 30 years of broadcasting to support individuals with barriers to print. Learn more at aincolorado.org/30years.